The following is intended for mature audiences only. Discretion is advised.
Thank you so much for downloading this episode of So What Do You Really Do? The podcast where I, your host, Dieter Dennis Maller, interviews artists and entertainers about their day job. And the artist and entertainer on the program today is comedian, former NBC page, and marketing expert, PR person, Janelle Draper. I should not probably just say her name is, she's a job person thing, but you'll hear me say, it's all the same to me. I hate PR. I hate marketing. I hate all of that, even though it's kind of become one of the things I've had to do now as a comedian because of the world of social media. We've all become our own PR marketing executives for our own selves. It's disgusting. All right, let's not dwell on that because I will go down into a rabbit hole. There's a spiral. There's a spiral in the podcast. There, we're going to go downhill a little bit. Yeah, it's going to be, it's a fun one. No, it's a good conversation. It's a short one. My friend Janelle Draper. Janelle and I met. She is, I know you're so sick of this, but it's our real life. It's the thing that we have to come to grips with, that she's a pandemic friend. The pandemic is having a far long lasting effect on our lives. Sorry if it keeps coming up. There was conversation in the early days of the podcast with the network about let's steer away from the word pandemic and COVID and stuff like that, because we don't want the episodes to seem dated. And I was like, I haven't left yet. I'm still in that world. It's affecting my everyday life, the people we meet, the lives we lived. Okay, so I'm not going to dwell on it now, but Janelle and I met through doing Zoom comedy shows. I was here in Boston. She was in LA. We did shows for different people in Flappers Comedy Club. We were comedians on the same show. We were, you know, I did tech for shows that she was on. You know, we did the Boston Comedy Festival online, or was it, sorry. Yeah, we did both the Boston and the Burbank Comedy Festivals online that year of 2020. It was a fun meet. Well, she moved to Boston. And after, you know, when things started opening back up, she moved back to Boston, and she was seeing our friend Laura Severus at Laugh Boston. And I was there working tech at the time, and I saw Janelle and I was like, hey, Janelle, Dennis, we did online things. And she was very drunk. She definitely did not remember me. I'm willing to bet she doesn't remember any of our online interactions, but we've become, doesn't matter, because we've since become actual friends in real life. Even though this podcast is done remotely between the two of us, because she has now become bi-coastal. She was born and raised here in the Massachusetts area, moved to LA. She'll go through all that stuff. You'll hear the stories. And it's a good, fun journey, and it's fun to hear about the difference between working the same job at one location on the East Coast and working the difference on the West Coast. It's going to be interesting when talking about being a page for television shows, for late night talk shows, because we've talked about it before with other comedians on the show, and we'll hear all of that. Which, by the way, I do want to point out, I guess I do cameos now. I don't think anybody else wants one, but it happened. The UK Lee character from Boston Doctors. Look, I have a profound effect on people who come to Boston and get tours. A young lady who went on my tour last year with her significant other, they're celebrating an anniversary, and she reached out to me on Instagram. Was like, hey, we really loved the tour we did last year together, your tour. We talk about it all the time. Our anniversary is coming up. Would you send a special shout out video to my significant other, Patrick? And I told Bianca, I was like, absolutely, 100%. And so I think I went above and beyond. I did too much. I went too far. I did too much, but it's fine. They're loving it. I did a small little song for them. So I guess I'm going to throw this out there. If you want a song, an improvised, somehow maybe punk rock ukulele song from UK Lee, reach out to him on Instagram, UK Lee Duck. And maybe that's a thing I'll start doing. We'll see. Nobody else wants them, I know. But speaking of things nobody else wants to do, I'm going to ask you, I need you guys to do it. Comments. Whatever you're listening to this podcast on, whether you've been a longtime listener, where you're a first time listener, you're coming to listen to the program because you want to hear about Janelle's journey and story, which, sorry, Valentina V, I know you hate the word their journey, but you know what? I'm going to admit to being unoriginal when using that, but I'm willing to sacrifice that unoriginality for saying something like somebody's dirty. That was a very insider thing for one person that doesn't listen to the podcast because she refused to be on it. All right. Sorry. Meow, am I being catty? All right. I'll stop. But it's yeah. Anyway, let's get to it because Jenna has a really great story to tell. And if you want to reach out and have me do a song for you, you can do that on Instagram. So there we go. We did. Oh, this is what he did ask. Guys, when these, sorry, now that we're doing video, my intros are one takes. So sometimes I gotta remember to do things. Here's an inside behind the scenes. I could edit this out if it was audio only. I'm not editing it out. But what I need you guys to do is leave reviews on the podcast, whether you're a returning listener, whether you're a first time listener, please leave reviews. They help the algorithms. The algorithms. I know if you're a long time viewer, you've heard me talk about the algorithms and it rules my life. But it's so important to be able to share the experiences with the people that come on this podcast. When you, the listeners, when you, the viewers, leave comments on the places you listen to this podcast, iTunes, Spotify, even on YouTube. If you're watching on YouTube, give it a thumbs up, give it a like, subscribe to Big Comedy's YouTube channel. I know these are things we all hear. Like, comment, subscribe, hit the bell for notifications. I know we've all heard it. And there's a reason why we have to say it. It's a call to action. If we don't ask for the call to action, you don't necessarily do it. And it helps. It gets this podcast out there. This is not about money. This is not about vanity. I bring people onto this podcast because I want their stories to be told. I want people to hear it. And it's easier for them to hear it when more people are the ones that hear it. And the more they hear it, the farther it goes. Popularity begets more popularity. So thank you all who have left comments in the past, but please, for those who can, leave comments. Again, especially in the big podcast aggregators like iTunes and Spotify or where else you're listening or watching this podcast. In fact, you can watch it both on YouTube at Big Comedy Network on YouTube, and Spotify has a video podcast feature now. So if you're listening to it on Spotify, switch over and watch the video. Why not? See my face. You can see the fact that I'm wearing an Orioles hat today during this introduction because they're at the top of the division. And I'm not much of a sports fan, but when I'm happy Baltimore does something well, I get happy for them. So those guys are having fun. Speaking of fun, you're going to have fun listening to my conversation with comedian and former NBC page, Janelle Draper. Well, since we're talking about PR and marketing, I'm going to probably use that term interchangeably, even though you're going to correct me and tell me they're not the same thing. But in my brain, they are the same thing. But before you got into the PR marketing field that you work in now, you were a page at NBC, which, and I have a friend who worked at Letterman in DC, and I talked about his Will Abel's experience with, you know, just being a crowd of wrangler and his nightmares of dealing with, you know, drunk Karens who are day drunk at the, you know, trying to see a free celebrity sighting show at a bar on their way into the David Letterman show. But I'm assuming LA, working in the LA NBC Universal area, has to be incredibly different experience.
Totally. We like to joke that it was easier to get into the West Coast program than the East Coast, but I was just happy to be involved. You know, I worked really hard to get into that program, and looking back, I wish I had stayed in it longer because you actually get a full year to be a page and then go on assignment every 3 months. But once I was in it at the time, I was like, oh, this is just a competition to get your first job in entertainment from this pipeline program. And then when I did a certain assignment where I actually met an old boss of mine out at the Golden Globes, I was there as a page and I saw an old boss when I used to intern in New York in PR. And she's like, oh, you want to join my firm? We're starting an LA office. So I like quickly left the page program. And then looking back, I'm like, man, I should have rode that thing out till the wheels fell off. But it was a ton of fun. Unlike Will, our mutual friend who worked for Letterman, I was not annoyed with the guests that came to our show. I felt really bad for our guests because a lot of them were diehard Jay Leno fans, and they had driven so far to see him and be in the front row. But we, as pages, were not allowed to put anyone above, like, 34 in the front row. don't tell anyone. No, just kidding. Don't come back and get, don't come at me, old page bosses. It was this crazy thing called the Van Halens. We had to find so many Van Halens, meaning like they were hot, they were young, under a certain age, and they could sit in the front. Meanwhile, did they even know who Jay Leno was or even appreciate him? Probably not. But all these older women and men that drove hours to see Jay were up in the nosebleed seats. I mean, I'm exaggerating. You can't find a nosebleed seat in that theater because it was so small, but it was intimate. But still, they were like the ones that probably needed to be up front the most to see and things and to be able to run up and shake Jay's hand because he would always do this thing before he'd start filming. He'd always come out every show and just say, hey, any questions? Thanks for being here, and take some photos and shake hands, which is really cool. I love that he did that. But only if you were in the front, only if you were sitting on the floor could you go up. So all the diehards that had like walkers and shit were like slammed in the back because they weren't hot enough, which is so, that's so gross to think back on. But yeah, I felt bad. I was like, this sucks. And I couldn't admit to them. They'd be like, why do we have to go up here? All these empty seats are down here. I'm like, I know. It's crazy. I'm sorry. I'm just listening to my boss. Like, that's one of the things I'd say. But it was a lot of fun. I pretty sure I got lucky by getting in because, well, it's not like I got lucky because I worked really hard, but I had a couple friends who had done it. They put in a good word for me from my college. And I think what also really helped me is I was a communication major at a really small school. Shout out to Stonehill College in Easton, Massachusetts, like a little liberal arts school, Catholic college, which is really funny because I don't at all identify with being Catholic. But my head of the department, like, handpicked just like four of us students that he thought would be good pioneers of this LA internship program. Because he had this great idea that, like, hey, we have a DC internship program. We have a New York City internship program. We don't have an LA internship program. And it was really smart of him back then to say that. So he handpicked a few of us. Luckily, I was friends with the other girls. And we literally went to LA and started this program where we got to, like, represent Stonehill. We literally got to go out to LA as seniors in college. And for a whole semester, we just interned for class credit. We only had to take one class. When we came back for like winter break, we took like a week or 2 week long course, and that was like our class credits for the semester. So that's what I mean by I got really lucky, but they did not help us get the internship. So we defined our own internship. So I feel like I got lucky again. I was like at like a party with my sister in like New Hampshire, and I meet this really great guy who has a good friend who works at Focus Features. He goes, you need to get an internship. I go, yeah, I'm supposed to move there in like 2 weeks and I have nothing lined up and the school's not helping me. They're just like, good luck. So he lined me up.
That's interesting because my experience with working in the industry of radio, we also, like, TV and radio are the biggest, you know, internships where our industries with interns, like, historically. I'm sure, you know, there's lawyers' offices and like businesses and other like legitimate places that have interns too. But our experience with interns, like my experience with working in radio, I didn't do an internship. I went straight right into the radio field. I was lucky in the fact that one of my teachers had a pipeline to a radio station. It was like every couple of months, he was like, hey, send me your best student. And I was the only person she sent. And I just got a job working in radio, low level board operator.
You weren't lucky. You were the best student, but it's like, yeah, opportunity, preparation, timing,
luck meets opportunity is luck with preparation or whatever it is. I have no idea. I'm not great at fake quotes, of inspirational quotes. But the thing that I had to do with when I my years later when I had to train interns and stuff and deal with them. So many people took radio internships just because they needed an internship for their college, but they weren't in the entertainment field. Like, we had English majors, we had history majors and stuff. There's like, I just need to take an internship and radio sounds cool. I'm like, well, you're getting in the way of somebody that actually wants to be in this industry. Right. And then 2010 hit, and then nobody wanted to be in the radio industry again.
That's so funny. Yeah. Wow. It's interesting.
That's interesting that you became the beginning of a internship program for your college through NBC.
Oh, yeah. Oh, so that's the funny thing. Yeah. So then I'm at this party. I remember, so funny, because I go to my sister. I don't even want to go. Like, I don't even know I was going to be there. Like, I'm like being such a little sister brat. And then I went, and thank God I went, met this really great guy who goes, oh, my buddy works at Focus Features, which, if you listeners don't know, you know, it's a specialty art house film division of Universal Pictures, or was, but now it's since, it's now its own entity. So I landed an internship through a friend of a friend, a friend of a new friend, which is awesome. So I got to go. It was so cool. He was like, you want to do, and this is to your point earlier, he was like, do you want to work on PR? I go, nah. I was like, okay. Then I was like, no, I want to try marketing. He's like, all right, marketing. It's like kind of like very similar, you know? And so then I just ended up doing marketing for Focus Features as a senior in college. But they put us up at the Oakwood Apartments, the famous Oakwood Apartments, where they have a documentary about it, where Corey Haim died and yada, yada, and all these child actors go. They're like fully furnished places across from the studio, and actually across on the side that Focus Features was on the Forest Lawn, Barham Boulevard side, which is so convenient. I could like walk to my internship, got very lucky. And from there, that's when I learned about the PAGE program. I didn't even know about the PAGE program until I was at that film marketing internship on the lot, but kind of like the stepchild of the lot, you know, because we were in the very back. We weren't like Uni Pictures. We were like the art house kind of quirky step kid of Uni Pictures and Focus Features, but still great films like Lost in Translation and, you know, a lot of Sofia Coppola movies. But so then I learned about the PAGE program, and then I found other Stonehill College alums who had gone the PAGE route, and they vouched for me, and then I applied, and then I got in. But
and explain to the listeners exactly what does a PAGE do, because it's kind of an amorphous term, like producer. Yeah. Producers mean so many different things in so many, like my LinkedIn sends me so many producer jobs where it's like, oh, you worked in radio as a producer. Do you want to work as a producer at this manufacturing plant where you just watch people make things every day? I'm like, no, that is not the same industry there. LinkedIn.
Yeah, no, that's so true. A PAGE. So it's very hard to get into the NBC PAGE program. You know, they like to say that it's harder to get into the PAGE program than an Ivy League school. Crazy, because I want to hear.
Meanwhile, most of the people that get into the PAGE programs come from Ivy League schools.
Oh, I did also quickly notice I was like the only non-NEPO kid, and I was just like, it was funny. I was learning a lot back then. It was funny being like such a fish out of water right out of college, 3,000 miles from home and everyone I knew, starting on my own and realizing like, oh, so you're, yeah, the connections were insane, the people I met. So, but it was really interesting and really cool. But so it's really hard to get in. And then once you get in, you are essentially a glorified intern. Again, the term intern comes up, but you know, you're kind of like a gopher. Like, we need coffee. We need someone to print out agendas. We need someone to do desk coverage. It was answer phones, you know, really easy admin duties, but seemed like a lot more important because you're in such a competitive program. And what they don't always advertise is once you go through all the hoops to get into the program, which is, you know, several interviews and, you know, you have to do an assignment. New York is even more intense. New York, you just get like a presentation. And that's why we joke that's way harder to get into the 30 Rock PAGE assignment than LA. We didn't have to do like a PowerPoint, but we did have like a time, like certain amount of time to answer all these questions, like what programs on NBC mean the most to you, and like, what do you hope to bring to the program? Where do you see yourself? What are your, you know, I guess typical interview questions, but you had to put in like essay format. And then you have the interviews in person and on the phone. But once you're in it, they call them classes. It's like, I was in a class of like December 2012.
No, you're doing the LA thing where you did not want to admit your age. You didn't want to hint out your age to everyone.
Who cares? I'm 35. I don't give a fuck. I don't care. Okay, it's 2012, class of 2012. There's like five of us. And then all of us are in this class now, this program, this historic program where people like Regis Philbin was in it. And who else? I mean, the list goes on and on. Aubrey Plaza. And there's so many people that became great successes that were first pages. And that's why it's historic. But you have to compete once you're in the program after you've already gotten in. The work doesn't end. The competition just steps up. So there's these things called page assignments. So they'll list an assignment up on the board, and all the pages in your class and below, so newer ones and older alumni ones that are still in their year program, will compete with you to get this 3-month assignment, because you go on rotation. You'll do 1 3-month assignment, then the next one. So typically, ideally, you'll have like 3 different 3-month assignments, you know, within your, and then like 1 month is like your training period, and mostly you're just working like at the Burbank lot, seating people, corralling audiences for the Tonight Show, and fulfilling ticket requests and things, and working in the office and answering phones. So it was a really cool experience, but it was very cutthroat in terms of like who wanted the development jobs, who wanted the certain like PR jobs, or the different, when I say jobs, I mean assignments. So, but it was a lot of fun. You had to wear a uniform, you had to give tours of the Burbank lot on the days that you weren't on assignment, which was also really exciting and also really eerie, because it's just like very like dead sets of like Days of Our Lives and like dusty old, like, who's paying for these tours? But I did really learn to appreciate, I didn't have to learn it, I appreciated it right away. It was really cool to see the original set of the Johnny Carson show, and to see where like Frank Sinatra would stop and get his shoes shined, and to see where Don Rickles would be, and Fred Astaire. And I did learn a lot about like the golden days of Hollywood, which is really cool. And I feel grateful for that. And that was really exciting.
What's interesting about the program that you're talking about is that it's so competitive for such an entry-level administrative position. Like, you're working in TV, but you're not learning anything about TV. Like, all the skills does apply. Like,
yeah.
Ticket sales and doing ticket sales and paperwork applies to so many industries.
Yeah.
And yet you want to work in TV and you're working at TV. Is the program competitive because it's somehow that prestigious when you say, like, on your resume, it says you're a page at NBC and that holds more weight in the industry? Or is it competitive because they're like, look, you're going to be around celebrities, we need to weed out the crazies?
I think both. I think they are looking, they do look at it as like a pipeline program. So they do look internally to pages first to fill roles. So even though you're not actually taught a ton, the way they look at it is you have exposure, and not really to celebrities, mostly to like the executives. So they do say, when you're a page, please reach out. These are the executives you should try to like sit down with. Here's who has like an open door policy. So I think just that they expect you to kind of do a lot of your own educating of like the company and the industry by attending certain, you know, sessions, speaker panels, like just things internally that NBC be putting on. And, you know, they really wanted you to be proactive in reaching out to people to sit down with, have informationals, have generals, have coffees. And with like former pages who are now executives, or former pages who are now just entry level, but they got their foot into a permanent job. And then also just people that weren't pages who are executives, like, you were supposed to meet with all those people if you wanted to like make a name for yourself in the program. And I do think it holds a lot of weight. Like, it's nice for you to remind me that. And it was so sweet when you're like, I'm so glad we could finally make this work. I'm so happy you didn't give up on me and, you know, my ADHD didn't win the battle here. I'm glad we finally sat down and found a time. It was a great scheduling tool that works really well. I wish more people would use, but I'm so glad you kept on me for it because, you know, what's funny is I look at that time, I almost don't even recognize myself. I'm like, oh, that was a whole different chapter. I kind of can't even believe I did that because it was so different. But yeah, it's a nice reminder of like where I started because, and I'm out of the corporate world now. Like I've been out for about a year and a half and now I'm just full-time comedian and producer. And I forget how much that page thing had to wait when I was in corporate world. Like for instance, when I got my job assisting the head of the offbeat comedy channel, IFC, they did shows like Portlandia, Marin, Comedy Bang Bang, Doc Now. I got very close with the head of programming, even though I was assisting and my job was to be the EA to the head of the network. I got close to her direct report, Pete Aronson, who was the head of programming and production, because he heard I was a page. He goes, oh my God, you're a page. So was I. And that's an immediate bonding factor that you have. So that was really nice. I feel like that shortcutted me because no one else in that building besides he and I were pages. So that was really special. And even though we had completely different experiences, like he was really lucky where he was, excuse me, a page where he got to be on this, he got to be running around with, the Golden Girls. Like what was that? Oh my God, I'm having that brain fart because who was that beloved one who passed away, the lead that was in everything? Betty White, of course, Betty White.
Yes.
He was like, he had built a relationship with Betty White because he was like in his 20s, like running around, like assisting her and things. Like he had a much different experience than I did, but then it helped him go on and be an EP on the Bernie Mac show and all these things. But because he saw that I had been a page myself, he was like, oh, that's cool. We have that in common. So we had that shorthand. So I think it works twofold to give you a long answer to your short question. You can cut me off at any point. I have a tendency to go very, very wordy.
No, that's why I edit. That's why I have editing skills. Because when somebody goes too long, I'm like, and we cut snip here and we snip there. And now it sounds like less rambling.
Good. We love that.
Most of my interview skills are done in the edit. If you knew how many times I redressed in the clothes that I did a podcast recording in just so I can say a question and make it sound I wasn't a babbling idiot going, you know, with the mate, with the thing, when you did the thing, you explained
like
it.
Me going like,
I've had to redo some of my own questions
anyway. Okay. Yeah. So funny.
Well, that's so interesting. Cause like to hear your side of it, like to hear that there are executives who are willing to help out the younger generation of people coming in, because that was not my experience in anything, especially here in Boston comedy. There now, and when I moved here from Baltimore in 2013, there is no mentorship here. There was some small mentoringship in Baltimore and DC when I left there. I didn't have anyone like that, but there was guys that would, you know, that were there who are experienced that were willing to give information. In the radio industry, it's so small and it's so everybody does everything kind of thing. Like if you look at the amount of people that produce a radio news program compared to the amount of people that produce a TV news program, it's night and day, the skeleton crew that is radio compared to television.
Wow.
And so there's really not a mentorship. I've had friends in the radio industry, like my buddy right now, Jackson Blue, who unfortunately just, for the first time in his entire 25, 30 year career of radio, lost his job and was fired. He didn't walk away from a station. The station fired him because of this, that, whatever. And he's talking about going through his mentor. He actually had a mentor growing up, which is rare in the industry, because when I looked up to the jocks that made me, I got fortunate to work with the people that inspired me to get into radio.
That's really cool.
And half of them didn't want to talk to me because they were worried I might take their job. Like that's how, like when you listen to a radio morning show and they do reruns on the day that they're out, it's because they don't want somebody else coming into their time slot and doing a better job.
Wow. You know, I think the difference there, though, I mean, that sucks. I think the difference is that in the corporate world, in the like business side of TV at NBC anyway, such a like well-oiled, crazy hierarchical company, there were so many clear tiers and steps involved that they were never worried. You know, an executive or manager, even an assistant, was never worried that like a low level paid was coming after their job, because it was like, oh, I got this desk job, I'm good for at least 1 to 2 years unless I really fuck up. Like, you're not going to replace the assistant. If anything, they'll have to make their pay. This is another thing. Assistants in the office that, you know, used to be pages want to kind of mentor the page that comes in as an assignment at their department, because then once that assistant hopefully gets promoted to manager or the next opening, they can then tap into the page and say, hey, you've been the page, you know, you've been here on assignment for this many months, you've been doing a great job. I want to train you, or we want to look at you to take the assistant job. So like, really, it would actually benefit the permanent employees more so to befriend and groom and mentor the pages, so that they can then like trust who they're hiring, and then they can delegate down. And that did happen often. But yeah, I think with radio, it's so much more like Wild West, right? Like, you have a great voice, you have a great take. So you weren't even an intern, you just went right to your job. You come in one day, you fill in for someone, if you do a great job and the results show like, oh, more people are staying on, more listeners, like, you can't argue those facts. But when it comes to like, there's a system in place, they're not going to leapfrog, because that's such a no-no. Like, you don't email, you know, someone's boss or boss's boss to say like, hey, I'd love to apply for this job. It's like, no, you have to wait your turn. You know, there's real clear set. I had friends that were pages that stayed in departments for 3 years before they went from assistant to manager. Then they stayed for 6 years before they went from manager to director and then VP. And it's just like this, you got to really love what you're doing, but they really like, they're lifers and they just believe in this process of this like slow death promotion.
That's so great to hear that there is such an organization to that side of the industry. Cause again, also I've been throughout the all entertainment mediases, and I've worked, you know, on movie and TV shows as both actor and crew member. And I've done tech, and I've done, you know, in front of the camera, behind the camera. And let's be honest, my best side for the camera is the one that's behind the camera. But the amount of times that I've worked on a set where it's like, oh, you know, like you're telling me, hey, do not be afraid to reach out to executives above you and talk to them and set up appointments. If you talk to somebody, if you talk to Chris Evans on the lunch line, you're fired.
Wow. Yeah.
Like, I've been in that environment. Like, I had, I worked on a, I was a, I did a bunch of background on the TV show Nosferatu same network, did AMC.
Yeah, that's the, and I know Nosferatu for Shudder or for, I worked for, AMC owns and operates IFC. So that's funny. I know that show. Yeah.
When I was working on Nosferatu, Zachary Quinto, who was the star of the show, comes up to me, like, and by the way, he's in like full monster makeup while eating lunch. Like, he's just tiny, putting tiniest little food through his prosthetics. And so he comes up, he just walks up to me, taps me on the shoulder, and is like, hello, I'm Zachary. I'm like, hi, I'm Dennis. And we're talking just about the food, like the cakes at dessert on the lunch line. And we're talking about that for a minute or two, just a very innocuous conversation. And then he goes, all right, goodbye. And then walks away. And then I go sit down. Everyone's like, oh my God, you're going to be in so much trouble. What were you talking to Zachary Quinto about? You're not allowed to talk to the leads. I'm like, he walked up to me. So I don't know how I'm going to get in trouble when I just responded. Like, he was just being nice and polite because he's a good person. And I've heard many stories from other people that he's a nice guy and this and that, whatever. But it's like, that's the kind of culture that when you're an actor on set, where you're like, you're only allowed to talk to certain people, you know, like the director's not allowed to talk to us. He has to go through. There's so many weird hierarchies in the.
That's so crazy.
Entertainment side of the business. Yeah, it's crazy. But when you were working in the program, you said that you always knew you wanted to work in TV. What was it about, you know, a young Janelle Draper that made her want to go into TV? Like, I went into acting because I have what Kevin Pollak calls the hey, look at me disease.
So I also have that disease for sure, but I didn't have. I have that disease, have and had, but then I had another disease that worked completely in conflict with that disease, which is like the, you know, just insecure and young and didn't think I could did not know how to navigate a career successfully in showbiz from the performer side. But what I did know is that if I worked really hard and studied and made connections and worked at companies that were involved in showbiz, that would amount to something. So I found success on the corporate side, which is what I felt like I could control, and I could not get overwhelmed by, you know, all of the things that go into being involved in front of the camera. So I always was just so fascinated by the idea of storytelling and film crews and TV and media, and just my favorite shows in NBC growing up were Seinfeld. My favorite shows in general were just Seinfeld and Friends. And I always watched them with my family growing up. So it was a real easy decision for me to say, oh, I would love to work on The Lot. Like, that just sounds exciting. It sounds like every day would be a new, different day. It sounds like I'd learn a lot. I'd be around people that are passionate, that are doing non-traditional careers that are nothing like what I know from around home. And so it just was like, done. It was like, duh and done. Like, I needed to do that path. It was really clear for me. As soon as I realized it was like an opportunity through the internship programs that my school was offering, that's when I knew it was like, we got it, you know? So it's funny though, I didn't do theater or acting or anything really too much growing up. I did a little bit, but I think I was excited about the idea of being behind the camera too and having some control, perceived control, and creating. And so I wanted to learn both sides.
That's fascinating to understand that some people like me, I get in front of the camera because I wanted that attention. But where I grew up, we didn't have people who wanted to create. We didn't have people who wanted to direct. We didn't have people who knew how to use cameras or microphones. And that's why I got into the tech side of the entertainment industry, is because I had to fill both roles. If I wanted to make a movie with the borrowed camcorder from my uncle, who definitely didn't work for the mob, you know, I had to also operate the camera, figure out how to use it. When I wanted to, when I started having a passion for music, I had to learn how to record audio and use digital editing software, because I wanted to be able to record those things and there was no one else around to use it. And it's fun when you have some people that follow a path when they're like, oh, I like the organization. I like the creation. I don't need to be in front of the camera, but I want to be part of the creation process. Mm. And then you found that path to it.
Yeah.
Is there, from the family side of things, when you were growing up, were your parents very organized?
Yeah. My mom's definitely organized. And my dad has, yeah, both of them chose, like, you know, more secure, stable, organized careers. You know, my dad is, CEO of a credit union and decided to go get his law degree. And my mom had some pretty great professional careers, jobs, but then she, you know, quit that to be a stay-at-home mom. But, you know, we didn't know too much as a family collectively about like how to break into the industry. It's just that they then supported me to follow my dreams and supported me to go to LA and just said, you know, you really should do this. So that was cool. But I mean, not supporting me financially. Like, I supported myself, which was like supporting me emotionally and mentally. You know, I mean, it was definitely hard the first couple of years living in LA. You know, I remember the first job offer I got out of the Page program. I was so excited. I called my mom, and it was to be a junior music publicist for a pretty reputable music PR firm that was like, we were repping at the time, like Lenny Kravitz, Alanis Morissette, Adam Levine, Gautier, that one hit wonder and things. Remember that? Someone I used to know.
Yes. Everyone does. The interesting thing, this is the weird zeitgeist, yeah, where you curate your whatever, is that my sphere of entertainment at the time showed me more of that. There was a YouTube band called Walk Off the Earth or Walk Off the World, something like that.
I remember.
And they just did covers. And somehow they did a version of Gautier's Someone You Used to Know, where all four of the bandmates played the song together on one acoustic guitar.
That sounds Walk Off the Earth.
I knew that version, not the original Gautier version. For the longest time, I never heard the original version. Somehow that Walk Off the Earth version, where they're all playing it on the guitar, showed up in my zeitgeist so much more heavily than the actual song of it.
That's so funny. They came to one of our, they did a showcase at, this is why I know them, they did a showcase at, when I was working in NBC in music for the head of supervision and licensing for NBC, they came and showcased for us, that band. So I definitely remember that. That's so funny. Yeah. But so they offer me a job and I was so excited and I call my mom and they offer me $25,000 a year.
Oh, I'm excited for 20. Remember when you were young and $25,000 a year sounded like everything in the world?
Yeah, my mom's like, sweetie, that's nothing. Can you get them up a little? So then I got them to 32 and I'm like, oh my God, this is so exciting. Like I have a job. I have a permanent job. So I left the PAGE program to go work for this PR firm. And I'm like, oh my God, it's crazy. But I digress.
I had a radio job offer me $30,000 a year to do my entry level job. And I was like, I make more than that in tips doing duck tours.
Right.
No, I'm not moving back to Baltimore for $30,000 a year. No, so like I want to go back to the radio industry and radio has proven they don't want me, but I'm not doing that job for that little bit of money again. No, absolutely not.
Oh, I still have one of those duck bills that you blow. That goes, it sounds like a duck.
Well, all right. So what made you get into stand-up comedy then? Were you already? I mean, you're a fan of Jay Leno, obviously, and the Johnny Carson and all that. I grew up at the end of the 70s, 80s comedy bubble. So when I grew up, stand-up comedy was everywhere. And then all of a sudden it disappeared. And then in the early 2000s, it came back again.
Yeah.
And I already knew, you know, how long it takes and how much effort it takes to become a comedian. Like I knew the inside workings of it before the second bubble blew up and started coming in the early 2000s. Were you familiar with stand-up comedy? Because I actually have a lot of women I know who do stand-up comedy and never saw a woman do stand-up until they started doing stand-up.
Yeah, it's funny you say that. I never watched SNL as a kid. I never really loved stand up. I just knew it from Jerry Seinfeld. That was it. But my dad always told me I was funny and he really encouraged me while I was a page to take a stand up comedy class when I was in LA. And so I did and I loved it. And then I was hooked. And so that was really when the obsession began. And so because my dad was
I got a question. How much of your comedy career is because your dad is a Santa comedy tiger mom and was living vicariously through you?
Probably like 90% of my And now I just started to get him, I just got him into comedy now, like 12 years later. Now I have him doing shows with me, you know, maybe like once a month, but he's doing pretty great. It's pretty crazy. He's such a natural. It's really fun to do that with him. But yeah, no, he was a big fan of Chelsea Handler because Chelsea Lately was the big show on air at the time. And he would go to all her book signings. He just would buy me her books. He just thought she was hilarious. And of course, I also did. I thought it was cool that my dad, I mean, I always knew I was goofy. The funny thing is, I was always a class clown. Like, I was always trying to make people laugh. I always knew I wanted to be entertaining for people. I even wrote a college essay about this, that I wanted to go to campus and be entertainment for people. Not in the way of like going to theater, but I wanted to do things like balance a water glass on my head in the cafeteria and like burp the alphabet and like do silly goofy dares, like run past the like football team in a really embarrassing way. Like I prided myself on being like a daredevil, goofy class clown type that didn't get embarrassed easily. And then I didn't realize all these years later, it really played into stand up. So it's like, no wonder why I went towards it, but it took my dad pushing me. You know, I was very lonely and kind of lost when I first moved out here. Because I said, I don't know anyone. I'm so close to my family. Where are all my friends? What am I doing with all my time? I worked so hard to get into this program, and it's actually giving me too much extra bandwidth. What do I do with all my spare time? Because like I said, once you got in, it's just glorified intern. And so my dad said, take a class, do stand up. And I took it, loved it. And now there's like no looking back. So, and then what really hooked me was when Amy Schumer came out with Live at the Apollo. And that was just such an incredible album. I thought that was really spoke to me. She had her rise, she had her cute little skirt, her dress, and she had just like you know, she had just crushed The Last Comic Standing. It was like her first special on HBO. My dad bought me that DVD and I just rewatched it and and I said, I want to do that. And then he took me to see Jerry Seinfeld live. So I feel very fortunate. My dad pushed me early on, and now I'm pushing him. So,
well, I imagine working in the industry and then having to work in marketing, dealing with social media, that had to work hand in hand with the stand-up comedy, because we have to do everything now. We're our own content the word content producer. Like, it's just such a word. Like, it means, it's like producer, where it means almost nothing.
Totally.
You know, yeah. Like, I had, you know, my friend who is the morning show back in Baltimore on the show, and we talked about that, where it's like, you're a content producer. I don't know what that means.
Yeah.
Like, you're a radio jock. I know what that means. You're an actor. I know what that means. You're a chef. I know what that means. When you say, I produce content.
Yeah.
Do you shit in your hand and then show it to people? Because that's content right there.
Yeah. Is it your morning shit? Exactly. Yeah. It is a lot to try.
Or does your knowledge of social media there work like the way it does for me, where it drives you crazy, where you're like, oh, there's algorithms, there's times of days, there's things. Does your knowledge of social media drive you crazy, or do you think it helps you when it comes to having to help promote your own self and your own shows and your own comedy business?
I guess.
Because the algorithm is a nonstop, living rent-free right in my brain at all times.
I know. Isn't that the goal, to try to silence that and get back to the love of it, to get back to the joy of creating and of just writing jokes and performing? And I do wish people say, I wish we were back in time. Like, people say, oh, you're so lucky now. We didn't have it that lucky when I was your age. Anyone can be discovered now. Anyone can just put stuff out there. I said, take me back to the Johnny Carson days. I much prefer that, where you're, you'll never keep me off the stage. Like, I love the hustle. I love the grind. I love to meet people in person. I love to get up on stage. What I don't love, sitting, cranking my neck, scrolling, comparing the doom scroll, the fatigue, staring into a screen, the disconnect when you're in a green room and all the comedians are just trying to, I hate all of that. I hate it all so much. When I started stand up in 2012, none of this shit was around. I did it for the love of getting on stage, telling jokes, and connecting. So I will say, I know more having worked in it, but I don't know that it always helps me, because I think I also get in my own way. It's a lot easier to market a brand or a product or someone else that's not yourself. There's still a lot of stuff I have to work through. I've been getting a lot better at just like throwing stuff at a wall and not being so precious about what sticks and what people see. And I've been building a thicker skin to a lot of like mean comments and stuff. And so I guess that comes, I mean, that I can also learn from monitoring like a big brand's account, because you're like, oh, just people are awful no matter who you are, no matter, you know, what you do, who you are. So it does help me, but it still doesn't give me like any of the answers. It's still all a big mystery to me as well, Dennis. It still frustrates the hell out of me. I definitely am someone who like believes if you have the extra little money to put at having someone help you edit or post, go for it. Because I do believe like to free up that bandwidth, to get back to the writing, to get back on just trying to get yourself booked and get on the road. Like, that's a full-time job, let alone not having to churn out clips and reels and TikToks and a podcast. And so I'm often overwhelmed and overworked and tired, I try to take myself back to like, I love this. And if I wasn't doing this, what would I be doing actually? And I just, you know, I try to count my blessings as often as I can. And I try to just, honestly, stuff like this helps a lot. Like, I'm really glad that you asked me to be on it. I'm really honored, because it's so rare that us as comedians look back and go like, you know, or like, oh, I did that. But it's nice to kind of put things in perspective and go like, oh my gosh, over like 10 years ago, I had the kind of balls to do this. Like, what, you know, you take those big swings when you're younger, because you don't know anything, so you have less to lose. And I think there's a part of me that wants to hold on to that sentiment. And so I don't know how that plays into my everyday process, but I think it's like not caring as much and just trying to like enjoy what I'm doing, because not being so result oriented is important, I think, when all this stuff is going on, like social media and numbers and follower count. So thank you for having me like kind of look back at like, oh, that was cool. I had that slice of life, you know, because I don't think back then I was so focused on what everyone else was doing because we didn't see it all the time. And now we're just, you know, hitting us in the face all the time. The comparisons.
That reminds me, like, I was excited to be on Twitter back when you could, before the iPhone, when I could tweet through text messages. And I was excited because to me, this was a new medium.
Yeah.
It was a new way to express myself. In radio, when we started doing video content on the web, I was excited because like, oh, this is a new medium. This is a new way for me to express myself. This is a new platform, new ideas. And now all I think about, oh, is this going to get me likes and views? Or why did that get that person? Why did Hawk to a fucking girl get?
I know what it's.
Why?
Like,
why is she on Whitney Cummings' podcast?
Oh my God.
And we're here complaining about why she's on Whitney Cummings' podcast.
That's actually such a good point. And you know what? I bet you she did not care or know. And I heard she didn't even have an account, right? So it's like,
nope.
It really is the people.
She's not on social media. She would just worked at some factory in Tennessee.
So I think
she's a 7 at best who just. Like, hey, I'm drunk. I'm going to say something slutty. I bet she's never even sucked a dick before. Cool. She was just like, oh, here's a moment to be funny.
Oh,
I'm throwing that down. Nobody's come down and told. I'm putting this on recording right now. Hawk Tua has never had a cock in her mouth because I'm going to say that because you know what? Somebody would have stepped up by now and like, yeah, dude. She's a 10 out of a 10. Nobody has. Nobody's pointed out. Nobody's come out and was like, nah, you know what, dude? She's a 2. She does not. She's never hocked to her. I'm going out there. She's a liar who just got lucky.
You said, okay. She's cute, though. You got to admit. She's not. You don't think she's. I think she's adorable.
She's all right.
Okay, to your
point. She's all right. I mean, she's not unattractive.
No,
she's
no.
All right. With the right makeup, she's a 7.
What?
7.5.
I disagree. I think she's actually super cute. Okay, no, to your point.
By the way, I'm a 2. I know this. This is not me I'm a 2. I know I'm a 2. I'm fine with being a 2. My dog's a 10. Hawk Tua's, she's a 7 at best.
I don't think we should be judging how you and I look. I'm just saying, no, I think, Dennis, here's what I think. Your point saying, like, she looks like she's never sucked a dick, I think that's why she went viral, because she has that wholesome, like, small town girl, lives with her grandma accent. I actually think that's part of the intrigue with her. Like, I think if she did seem super slutty, so I think that's honestly something that worked to her advantage. I think you hit the nail on the head. Like,
oh, you're right. Being super slutty didn't work out for Kim Kardashian at all.
Oh, no, I mean, but she also had a lot of other things working. I just mean, like, I think because it was just such a, like, in the moment, I don't give a fuck, and she looked so, like, girl next door, and she was like, Hawk to ya. You're like, whoa. I will say, I don't think all this viral fame is worth what she did. Of course not. But I will say, clearly there's something people, like, found likable about her. I think she's adorable. But, like, that could be, like, her cute little accent, the little blonde hair. Like, she's just a cute little package, in my opinion. But I think it's totally insane, and I don't think it's deserving what she's, like, I don't think it's fair. But there's no fairness in any of this, right? Like, who's to say, I mean, you nailed it on the head, like, or the guy that did Jury Duty. I mean, he was very likable, but he just got cast. Think you remember the movie the TV show Jury Duty on Amazon?
Oh, the guy where James Marsden, everyone's fake actors around him?
Yeah, I mean, he blew the heck up, and he just was, like, thinking he was signing up for Jury Duty with, like, a little local crew. So I do feel like so much of this industry is how likable you are, and it's hard to show your authentic likability when you want it so badly. So when we have that in our head, unfortunately, that's why I think people hit their peak of likability factor and get their viral fame when they're not trying. And that's why love comes to you and big breaks come to you when you're not trying. That's why they say actors get the big break when they're on their honeymoon. That's why I met my boyfriend when I was not even trying. Like, I met my boyfriend when I had already moved to LA and I was just back in Boston doing my Wilbur show. He was at the show just as an audience member. And we hit it off because I was like, I don't give a fuck. Meanwhile, I was there for a year and a half prior, did not meet one guy that I connected with that was a gentleman. A lot of guys ghosted me. A lot of guys were dicks So I do think there's something about that desperation that I want to channel. I want to channel the I want to channel the younger, like, Paige, don't give a fuck mentality.
Well, some of this is going to be inspiring motivational quotes for somebody. So I'm glad brought that. Here's the benefit of the Hawk to a girl. She made us realize that, you know, sometimes you just have to not give a fuck, be able to make it in this world.
Yeah, I would love to keep chatting with you another time. I'm like sad I have this heart out, but like we should.
No, that's fine. Yeah. So, but please tell people. So now that you're a full-time comedian, tell people where they can see and support everything Janelle Draper Comedy.
Oh, thanks. If they can go to follow me on Instagram and or TikTok, but Instagram is better for where my show dates are. I update that more frequently than my website, and it's just my handle on Instagram and TikTok is at Janelle Jokes, J-A-N-E-L-L-E, Jokes.
Awesome. Well, thanks for, I'm glad we finally got to do this. We got to have the conversation. I love to hear the difference, like I said, because I've had many people tell me about working in the New York side of the NBC and CBS world and hearing the difference on the West Coast side, which I was very expecting a different approach to it. And that's what I got to hear. So it was great to finally catching up with you a little bit. And then next time you're coming back to town next month. So we'll hang out again in real life. Cause we are pandemic friends that became friends in real life. Because even though you're a Boston comedian, we met through Zoom during the whole Zoom comedy thing through Flappers. So
yeah, that was
see friendships formed through the COVID. You guys,
I agree.
Zoom comedy works for something.
You really are, Dennis, such a great interviewer. You know, Jessica Kirsten was right. You're fantastic. This has felt like 5 minutes. Like I'm generally sad to like have to go. So. Please, let's do this again, whether we're just hanging out or, you know, recorded, because I'm so glad we got to do this. This is fun.
Awesome.